Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Today we're talking about the war in Afghanistan with author and historian Ben Jones. Ben Jones is Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Dakota State University. He retired from the Air Force after 23 years. He retired at the rank of Lieutenant Colonel. He's been an assistant professor of history at the U.S. Air Force Academy. He served in Afghanistan twice. From 2011 to 2012, he was a member of the Strategic Transition and Assessment Group. He's the author of the book, Eisenhower's Guerrillas, the Jedburghs, the Maquis, and the Liberation of France, but he's also featured in a new book, which we're diving into today. It is called Our Latest Longest War, Losing Hearts and Minds in Afghanistan. Ben Jones joins me now at the studios, SDPB studios at the University of Sioux Falls. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for the chance to talk to you today.
Let's start with sort of the origins of this book, because it's noteworthy.
Yeah, the editor, Aaron O'Connell, we were in the same office for about a month or so in 2011. He was a Marine Corps Reserve officer and taking a tour from his job teaching history at the Naval Academy. So I was there from the Air Force Academy, he was there from the Naval Academy, and we were working on General Petraeus's Commander's Initiatives Group with about six or seven others. And then that tour ended. He went home. I went home. He went home in July of 11. I came home in January of 12. And sometime in early 2014, he emailed me and he said, Ben, I know you're a dean now and all busy and everything and can't do scholarship anymore, but how about writing a chapter on the transition since you worked on that in Afghanistan? The interest of the book really grew out of the counterinsurgency manual that was authored by, formally by Petraeus and Marine Corps General in 2007. And then University of Chicago Press decided that publishing an Army manual would be something that they wanted to do. There was so much interest in what was going on in Iraq and how the United States might do counterinsurgency and so forth that the Army puts this manual out for all of its people, and it's a PDF or whatever, you can download it or get a free copy. The University of Chicago Press in 2007 or 8 decided they would publish a copy and sell it on Amazon for $10. That did evidently pretty well. And then, so that was Aaron's hook to approach them about doing this book. Right. He said, how would you like some practitioners who were there in Afghanistan trying to implement the counterinsurgency doctrine, who are also scholars and have their experiences to hold up against that doctrine and their scholarship, whether it be history or political science or sociology or whatever their scholarship might be in, and to write a book. And they thought that was something they wanted to do. So then he started formalizing contributors, and he reached out to me then.
I think we almost need to comment on the fact that the book was public. No security concerns about that. What was in the original counterinsurgency manual that was okay to just share with the world?
Well, the formal manual?
Yeah, formal manual original.
Yeah, that has no operational details. This is, if in a perfect world, this is a manual for how a Marine unit or an Army unit would go and conduct counterinsurgency.
All right.
So these are the things you need to think about. These are the guidelines. If you have to deviate from that, then feel free to do that to a large extent. But these are the list of principles and the concerns and concepts that you need to think about.
So for folks who don't know, who gets that? Officers, enlisted?
Anybody who wants to go to the Army Doctrine webpage and download whatever, you can get the whole
bit.
Who actually reads it? Well, staff college officers go through and they will read large chunks of it, if not all of it. Enterprising officers who've never gone somewhere to do this new thing will say, oh, I've been ordered to Haiti to do a humanitarian operation. I don't know how to do that. I just go to the shelf, I pull off the manual, and I read it in the plane on the way there.
Right. So I'm enlisted. Yeah. You were an officer, and the fear of every enlisted person is that the officer just got off the plane after reading the manual.
Yeah.
So we'll just leave that out there.
Yeah.
Like, that guy just read the manual, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
There's a fair amount of that.
There's a fair amount of that. So we're being flippant with something mm-hmm. that's probably not flippant. But so let's go jump ahead a little bit before mm-hmm. we talk about the guts of the book. I want to. What was your role in the transition? How big is that staff? What exactly are you doing day to day from 2011 to 2012?
Okay. Well, the transition staff was run underneath the two-star general who was in charge of planning and operations for the commander, on behalf of the commander. And it's a coalition headquarters. And NATO is a part of that coalition, as well as other countries. So when I got there in January of 2011, there were 50 troop-contributing nations. So you'd walk down the opening, the foyer in the headquarters building, and you'd see all the flags. It was jam-packed full of flags. You go into the chow hall or the DFAC, the place where everybody eats, and it's like the scene from Star Wars. Everybody is there,
right.
You know, all the flags. And you think, well, it's a NATO operation. Why is this guy from Fiji here? Why is these people from Latin America here? Well, why are a medical unit from Japan here or so forth, or police units. Japan had actually uniformed troops prior to my arrival. They had a small contingent of medical soldiers there in Afghanistan. Everyone, for various national reasons outside of NATO, also wanted to contribute. So it was about half NATO and about half non-NATO. Even the Irish were there.
Really?
Yeah.
What were the Irish doing there?
They had a small group of seven guys, a couple enlisted, and four or five officers. So they were doing protocol and IEDs, or explosive, improvised explosive device, which is a modern term for booby trap.
Mm-hmm.
They were advising the headquarters staff and some of the forces on the latest type of enemy use of IEDs.
So herein lies one of the first challenges, which is there's a whole lot of people involved. Everybody's got their own agenda in some mm-hmm. ways. Everybody wants, when it comes to the transition itself, so we mm-hmm. should put this in context for people who don't remember. President mm-hmm. Obama is elected in 2008, mm-hmm. surge in 2009, mm-hmm. and now there's a deadline for American troop withdrawal
right.
by 2014. Is that the original deadline
yes.
that President
yep.
Barack Obama set? Mm-hmm. Now that transition plan needs to be implemented. Does everybody want that transition plan to happen, essentially? Does everybody want the same thing, and then they just have different reasons for wanting it? Or do people actually want different things?
People want different things. And that was the scope, the thing I tried to explain in my chapter, is that transition meant different things to different people. So to many of the allies, well, when I first got there, somebody shared with me a quote from Angela Merkel, the prime minister of Germany, or the that, hey, we went in together, we will go out together. So by that means, if you have 4,000 troops in Afghanistan, or if you have 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, we will draw down those troops proportionately. So no one gets to say, oh, your area is now transitioned over the Afghanistan troops, and you can leave lock, stock, and barrel, because many countries just had certain a province or a region in Afghanistan that they were in charge of. So if that region transitioned first or early in the process, you got to send all your troops home. She saw that. She's a very shrewd lady. She saw that as a way to maybe that nations might want to fudge the books and say, well, things are good enough here. We're out of here. And they could leave. And she made it her position, and it became kind of the accepted thing. No, we went in together. We will come out together. So everyone will draw down proportionately.
Is the situation untenable, and that's why the United States wants? Is it politically, President Obama runs on this, and it's a political issue, or is it a strategic issue that it's time to turn this over to the Afghans?
Well, I think it was both for him. I think from as far as I could discern from President Obama's perspective, as he came in, he ran on getting out of Iraq and winding down the presence in Iraq and coming to a positive conclusion in Afghanistan. I don't recall during the campaign they ever kind of illuminated what that was, but he then inherited a troop request from the Bush administration that President George W. Bush didn't wish to sign because he knew, I don't want to, you know, make this decision for my successor. So he quickly, when President Obama came into office, approved the surge. Then the new commander in Afghanistan finished a strategic reassessment and said, I need another 30,000 more. This caused a lot of consternation in the White House and in the Pentagon and so forth. And that was General McChrystal. McChrystal then was later fired for other reasons. But that request, I think, and Secretary Gates writes about this in his book, that request in President Obama's mind made him think, well, what the heck's going on? I just gave you these additional troops. My National Security Council advisor, who's a retired Marine Corps general, approved those. He's been to Afghanistan. He advises me to see the impact of those initial surge troops before I give you more. And this all goes to kind of a part of the discussion. I think it's unfortunate is sooner or later, very quickly, you wind up just talking about troop numbers.
Right.
Never did I ever hear anybody in a serious, responsible way who was in a position of authority from the president to the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State talk about goals and objectives in a public way that was aimed in getting the American people or the populations of the other troop-contributing nations to say, yes, we can go, that sounds achievable, it's desirable, and we can do what's necessary to accomplish those goals. And then once you define a goal, then you would go back to the generals and you'd say, okay, we're going to accomplish this. How many troops does it take? Instead, we have the argument about troop numbers before we know what we're doing, which is backwards. So we never really, now in classified documents, there would be a lot of, this is the goal and this is the aim, which is, I better not say what the those documents said, but they wouldn't necessarily be, you know, it's probably been leaked to the New York Times many times. But essentially it was...
You can Google it now.
Yeah, you can Google it. Essentially it was shutting down Al-Qaeda and trying to make Afghanistan not a haven for terrorism.
Right. That's what's at stake.
Right. That's what's at stake.
The big picture of what's at stake.
Right. And the question is, how do you do that?
Right.
And the debate that General Petraeus and McChrystal, and to some degree their predecessors, all wanted the strategy that I wanted to have was counterinsurgency. That can be done in various ways. The ways that General Petraeus wanted to do it and McChrystal wanted to do it was to think of it as an all-of-government approach. So we not only have military people doing military things, we will also do public works, we will also do education, we will also enable Afghanistan's government to grow and develop, to collect taxes, to be a normal government. Mm-hmm. And when you think about how far they have to go, things like, well, my first tour, I was there for a couple of weeks and I realized, okay, there's no functioning post office in Afghanistan. They have no way to collect an income tax because there's no ID number like we use Social Security numbers. People don't have addresses, no personal ID numbers. You can't get a library card, right? Mm-hmm. There's no way to function that way to collect taxes.
So the word normal government.
Right.
Is normal in an American
right. It's a normal in
sense.
American Western
and that
sense.
It does not exist.
No.
Nor does the foundation for it exist.
No. And the foundation is they have their own foundation that we find hard to understand.
Right. Let's talk about that cultural difference here and how the sort of clash of cultures really significantly impacted the transition. You know, really, and the war itself.
Yeah, sure. I began to realize that the war that's going on there now is really a search to find to win the peace, as you might say. If you think of World War II, which is an abnormal war in the American experience, by the way, it's very abnormal, but we think of that as the war. Mm-hmm. That, you know, when you think of war, you think of World War II and huge armies and navies and front lines that are discernible and a parade at the end of the war and the troops come home. Most wars aren't like that. We live in a part of the country where the Indian Wars went on for decades. Those wars didn't have that kind of thing. So when we think about war, you also think about the peace that results from the war. In fact, even the Second World War really wasn't, the peace wasn't solved in the Second World War until 1991, when the 2+4 Treaty happened and the Soviet Union dissolved and Russia, the United States, Britain, France, and the two Germanies decided on how Germany would reunite and how the peace would resolve in Europe. So if you think of 45 to 91 as kind of the time where outside nations outside of Germany are resolving their disputes, the United States and the Soviet Union and so forth, and then when that gets resolved, then we can resolve this hanging, this dispute right. still hanging over from 1945. And
which is what people don't currently understand about the Korean Peninsula.
Yes,
as
well.
Exactly.
Same
right. conversation.
It's the
yeah.
same conversation. Yeah. The war is still going on. Mm-hmm. There's just an armistice.
Right.
And if you're North Korea that fired off their ICBM a couple days ago, I'm sure 4th of July was chosen for a reason, mm-hmm. right? They're sending right. a message that peace has yet to be won in the Korean Peninsula. And it,
so there's no end. There's a transition mm-hmm. in this case.
Right.
And there's a deadline
there's
for
a
transition.
Deadline.
And
right.
there's great cultural differences for mm-hmm. how this whole thing is really unfolded up until now as well. How do those cultural differences sort of impact the transition itself?
Right.
And then let's get into sort of the leadership pushing that deadline. And are folks who are doing the work saying, slow down, mm-hmm. There's a different metric, as it were, to,
right.
to look at here?
Well, in November of 2010, General Petraeus had been in the job since July of 2010. And General Petraeus, in his capacity as a coalition commander, went to a NATO summit in Lisbon, Portugal. And he got the language written in the NATO Lisbon protocols that transition would be based on conditions. And so when the Afghans were ready to take over the security of their nation, that they would do so. And that transition did not mean... It explicitly says this. It did not mean a withdrawal of troops. Hmm. It meant that the Afghans were willing to win the war on their own to some degree. And that degree meant largely having a standing army and police force that could handle their own nation's security, even though others might be, because they can't really tax, they don't have the tax base to afford all this, mm-hmm. that other nations might be contributing funds and perhaps some advising along the way, and other assets, but that they would be in charge of the day-to-day combat operations against Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and so forth. That's what was in the protocol. So when he came back from that, then a few months later, when I arrived, he needed to set up a group of staff inside the headquarters that would deal with transition. So he grabbed some people from around the headquarters. I was one, kind of yanked out of that job, and told to go over here and do this. And I wound up sitting next to some RAF officers, some Kiwis, an Australian, a couple Australians. A Spanish guy joined us. So you can think, and we're all led by a British brigadier, Royal Marine.
Yeah.
It was one of the smartest guys I ever met in uniform. Really a brilliant man. About 7-8 of us, and we were told, okay, figure out the ways by which you will judge the conditions of the readiness of the Afghan forces and of the enemy so that we can balance, right, if you think,
right.
if we are handling the enemy in a certain area and the Afghans have to get up to that level of capacity, skills, and competency so they can handle the enemy in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So it very much depends on how, what the enemy activity is by region, by province, by city, versus what the Afghans are able to do for themselves. And then so over the course of 2011, we developed this, and this was taken from some other practices that were preceding that staff group that was set up to do this, about readiness and so forth. Now, if you think about how, as you were in the Marine Corps or so forth, you have ways that everyone agrees upon judging a unit's readiness.
Right.
You have so much gas on hand. You have so much ammo on hand. You have training. You have certain occupations within the unit that are trained to their skill level that they're supposed to be or so forth, or they're not, right? You have your people or you don't. They're trained or they're not. You know, it's or they're in some capacity of training. And they have all this process set up in the armed services already. Now you go to the Afghans and you look at the Afghan generals and you say, what's your stocks of supplies? Well, if they've just been selling them off because they're corrupt,
right.
They'll say one thing, but reality is another.
Right. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and we'll pick up there with sort of the role of corruption in all this and, you know, money, no tax base, who's paying for it, that sort of thing. Ben Jones is with us. We're talking about the book, Our Latest Longest War, Losing Hearts and Minds in Afghanistan. We'll take a quick break. Stay in the moment. SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking about the war in Afghanistan with author and historian Ben Jones. The book we're talking about, Our Latest Longest War, and Ben Jones is a contributor in that book. He is also the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Dakota State University. We left off with corruption, and I'm wondering what was the role of just the level of corruption in the Afghan government and how things worked there in the transition? How did that play a part?
Well, it's difficult a lot of times to discern because of the difference in the culture. And so what they might think is understandable activity or even expected activity would be that, you know, in their patriarchal culture, the head guy is to take care of everyone and distribute his largesse or his capacities or his materials or his jobs or his things like that. That's his job, and everyone's inside that clan or that family sees that as his job. The grandfather, the father, that's what they're supposed to do. So if they have these materials, these supplies, and they're not doing that, then they're not living up to their role in their society. That's the kind of the basic understanding that they have. We look at that and say, well, there's that mafia crime family just taking care of themselves.
Right.
They view a government as not having a role of, you know, active participation at the citizen level and so forth like we would. They see government's role as taking care of those people that they have obligations to take care of through family reasons.
Interesting.
So from us, it's corruption, it's illegal activity. We tried to root it out. They had a whole task force there led by General McMaster, who was a one-star at the time and a real bulldog and so forth. And but you can only go so far when you've got 1,000 years of that cultural habit that predates Islam. I had some guys tell me that's their old Soviet mindset. The Soviets had nothing to do with that mindset.
Right.
They encountered it as well. It frustrated them as well. In fact, I found, frankly, the officers, the generals who had been, as young officers, educated and trained in the Soviet Union were easier to deal with because, you know, communism, socialism is a Western idea, and at its base, it shares a notion of progress. That's a Western notion of progress, and that the calendar is, in many ways, linear, so that if we do this and this, tomorrow we'll be better, you know.
Right.
That notion is not, you don't find that kind of concept outside the West.
Right.
So,
during this transition, for the Americans who are there and coalition forces, what's the morale like as the deadlines get pushed a little bit, the conditions, you know, leadership wants the numbers to come down by a certain date.
Yeah.
Leadership on the ground says, you know, these conditions have to be met. It's not safe. There's a risk of doing this too quickly.
Right.
Does that begin to affect sort of the mood?
Well, yes. I mean, anytime you get a lot of mixed signals, you kind of wonder, well, do the bosses know what they're doing?
Right.
And when President Obama and political leaders would talk about transition is in numbers only all the time. Most of their rhetoric that we read in the papers was concerning numbers. We'd walk across the street to the U.S. Embassy, and they were talking about numbers. We were the only ones not talking about numbers, but we were the ones that were bringing about the transition on the ground in Afghanistan, the military ones, the coalition leadership, and so forth. And General Petraeus kept saying, no, this is conditions-based. This is conditions-based. It's going to go according to the Afghans' ability to take over the war, essentially. He briefed that then, and this was unbeknownst to me, although I saw the message traffic afterward. He went to a NATO meeting, and he briefed his timeline that there would still be some troops in the country, but that transition would start in every place in Afghanistan by the end of 2014. But because transition is a phased process, and that all the way through, there's four phases, and all the way through the fourth phase, there would still be coalition troops there alongside Afghan troops at some level, this became very alarming. And when that disconnect in communication between Washington and Kabul became apparent at that NATO meeting, General Petraeus was told through the Secretary of Defense, no, we will be, or through the NATO ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to NATO at that meeting, this isn't squaring with what the president has said, so how do you make sense of that? And in an email that ambassador wrote to me in 2014 in research for this book, he said kind of vaguely that General Petraeus's answer was unsatisfactory or something like that. So he reported that up, and then that became a talking point during an NSC meeting. President Obama felt very much like he was being pushed again to do this. I think his level of distrust almost approached probably Kennedy's level of distrust after the Bay of Pigs for the CIA, as guys are messing this up and I can't trust them to do the job and things are going wrong and I'm not going to be put in a box. And so he just basically said every time that it came up, this is the way it is. So in June of 2011, when Petraeus comes back to Washington to testify to take over the CIA for his Senate confirmations, he gets called to the White House for two or three meetings, I guess, to talk about the withdrawal and the transition. And at the end of the day, the end of the last one, President Obama pulls rank and says, no, they're all going to be out. So when we were told that over a video conference call in June of 2011, get back to your morale question. Morale hit the floor.
Right.
We had been working in an orderly transition that was going to, win the war, as far as we could tell, that would give the Afghans a chance to win the war. And now that wasn't going to happen.
What are the consequences of that? Are we seeing that today?
We are seeing that today. Exactly right. President Trump and Secretary Mattis, Secretary Mattis was Petraeus's boss when Petraeus was in Afghanistan at U.S. Central Command. They are now having to deal with the reality of what the NATO Secretary General, and I say this in the book, we can't do transition wrong, words to that effect, and he says that would be a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're seeing this now, and NATO recently heard our call or our commitment to send some more troops, and so they will probably be sending more troops. So we'll
disaster for whom? Go back a minute. That would be a disaster for whom?
Well, for all involved, I think the Afghans, for the United States, it could lead to another attack. I mean, if there's terrorist areas facilitating where they can do training and congregate and so forth and think of plots against the West, then that could be a disaster. I think that's what he was getting at.
So we have a new president, a new Secretary of Defense in the Secretary Mattis. I want to call him General Mattis.
Yeah.
Certainly, Mattis has the experience.
Yes.
It's being said that he's been given a lot looser reins to sort of lead whatever needs to happen next at will. This administration is more hands-off in that. Is that an opportunity? Is that an advantage? Are we still finishing what we started then at this point?
Well,
does the same transition, like, what does it look like now? Do you have the same transition in place that you're still trying to figure out how to support the Afghans in winning the peace? We're still trying to do that.
We're still trying to do that. And General Nicholson, who was a two-star there, who I talk about in the chapter, he's now the commander there. He's got two more stars, and he's the four-star. He understood the transition process back in 2011 as well as anybody. He was the one, kind of the lead point man for General Petraeus in negotiating things with the Afghans on how the transition would look, what readiness needed to be like, and so forth. But now he has, I don't know, 80,000 less troops. Most of the troops that he has, well, they're all doing one of two things. They're either advising the Afghan army or police, or they're conducting direct, what we call direct action against terrorists, Al-Qaeda and ISIS and so forth in Afghanistan and the Taliban. President Ghani of Afghanistan, he was also a part of the transition at the time in 2011. He wanted the transition to mean money coming into Afghanistan. He's an old economics professor, former World Banker, very educated man, spent most of the war outside of Afghanistan. So he doesn't have a lot of the kind of the political street credibility that a lot of warlords have, because he missed the whole war with the Soviets and so forth. But he's, I think he understands what needs to happen from the Afghan perspective. And he's willing to work with the United States and the Allies much more than Karzai was. So
I have a friend whose son just joined the Marines. Let's talk about those people who are signing up now and, you know, on the ground, willing to raise their right hand all over again. Mm-hmm. It's easy to say, take your time, make the transition right. But people are dying during this time. Americans are dying during this time, and it's costing a whole lot of money, a whole lot of American taxpayer dollars. What's the message that you would have to those families about what their kids are off to do now?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that, and that's really what it's all about. You have to understand, you know, we have had 20,000 troops in South Korea plus for since 1952. We had occupation forces and then forces, NATO forces in Germany and so forth. I think winning the peace is often something that certainly more valuable than winning the combat action in the war. For those who are considering joining now, what they would do is be a part of making sure that Afghanistan doesn't become a safe haven again. The tricky thing that I think in the end, the two things that President Trump and Mattis and General Nicholson and Secretary Tillerson are all going to have to figure out is how to starve the Taliban of its support, which is coming from Pakistan. General Nicholson has said in the Senate committee that he testified in January, this has to change. They've recently released a formal report saying we have to essentially make a sober judgment on what Pakistan is doing for us or to us. We have to stop sending them arms for their F-16s, updating their engine and equipment and so forth through all this stuff, because they clearly are supporting the Taliban. And I think, personally, I'd like to see the United States and India put the squeeze on Pakistan and start playing tough, because that's where the war, I think, is really to be won, is in the hearts and minds of the Pakistani government.
How do you defeat an ideology?
Well, you have to have some way to bring that ideology into the political process. So in Afghanistan, Ghani has started to do that. Actually, one guy, Hekmatyar, a couple of months ago, agreed to come back. He's been forgiven of his war crimes and combat action and so forth, and he's setting up a political party in Afghanistan. And his name was in the paper the other day, too, with the Ghani government, as he's forming a party and he's going to run his candidates in the elections and so forth. You have to get to a point where the various wings of the Taliban may wind up being split off and one by one come in from the cold and join the political process. They have to see that it's constant fighting is not going to get them where they want to go.
ISIS hold in Afghanistan? Does that exist? That's not part
of it. It does exist. Yeah. I was shocked about that, and I didn't believe it until I heard President Ghani say that there was ISIS in Afghanistan in an interview about a year ago. I was impressed with the Afghans in many ways. There's a small but meaningful Shia minority in Afghanistan. There was not, and is not, a lot of violence between Sunni extremists and the Shia community. Once in a while, there'll be something. Everybody reacts to that in a very positive manner. They don't, there's not a, you know, the Sunni-Shia split, they found a way to exist in Afghanistan. And so that type of ideological dispute or theological dispute within the Muslim community in Afghanistan is not something that usually erupts into violence, unless somebody comes in from outside and provokes it. And ISIS is trying to do that. And I think ISIS taking off was a feature of maybe the weakness of the Taliban and young men still wanting to do that, fight a jihad, and very captivated by ISIS ideology and what was going on in Iraq and Syria, and thinking that they would join this wing of ISIS in Afghanistan.
We talked earlier about cultures and the differences in these cultures, you know, the Western culture, American culture, Afghan culture. Let's close with that. Mm-hmm. And what I'm curious is, from the amount of time that Americans have been there and interacting with Afghans, is the understanding of each other's cultures getting improving?
Yeah.
And is it, I want to say, rubbing off at all, but do some of, for example, the way the American military handles women, mm-hmm. Is that having any kind of influence on Afghan culture? Or is that culture just what it is and you're not going to see those kind of understandings grow?
I think that culture is what it is. I've become more and more of a person who's trying to figure out what the culture is and a way to deal with it as it is and not change it. It will take lifetimes to change that, because at its base is a, in Western culture, when I teach a Western civ, I talk about the axis between Athens and Jerusalem, that there's a democracy founded in Athens, fueled by the monotheism of Judaism and Christianity, comes out of Jerusalem, and those two ideas form a concept that in the West, then over the next 2,000 years, 2,500 years, becomes what we see today. They did not have that access, those sets of ideas that kind of merged. They didn't go through a cultural and a religious enlightenment, a reformation, all these things that the West has gone through, which, by the way, this October we'll celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. So we're 500 years from that discussion within our own cultural, widely broad cultural faith of Christianity. They have not had that. To them, it's very strict. I was alerted one time that I had a Quran with me, and one colleague said, you know, you can't call that a Quran. You have to call it an annotated Quran, because it's a translation. So it's only a true Quran if it's in Arabic. So even the Afghans walking around with Qurans in Dari or Pashto, it was an annotated version. So that's how precise you have to be about the meaning of their religious faith or what they might pull out of the Quran. It's not something to be, it's taken extremely literally and at the cultural level, as opposed to our, you know, we have Baptists and Lutherans and Catholics.
Right.
All around town, you can drive up and down Western Avenue and see five different churches, or down 57th, and see. That's that debate we've decided to live together with. It. They have not decided that. They're either under the table with their heterodoxy, mm-hmm. or they're open in their conformity.
Ben Jones, the book is called Our Latest Longest War, Losing Hearts and Minds in Afghanistan. He is a contributor to that. It's edited by Aaron O'Connell. If you're looking for it at the bookstore, Ben Jones is the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Dakota State University. Always a pleasure. Come back again. Thank you.
Sure.